Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, a diversity of views on a similar topic. The big issue of the week, Joe Biden's first 100 days, talking to Congress, and pitching a lot more spending. Congress already passing $2 trillion for COVID relief. Now the talk about $4 trillion in spending for infrastructure, social programs, a whole lot of things you can do with $4 trillion. So we talk with California Senator Alex Padilla, we talk with U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, and also conservative commentator Michael Knowles of The Daily Wire. But let's begin with the junior senator from California on his 100th day in office. Remember, we talked with him on his first day in office. Now we check back in with him again. Senator Padilla is back with us.
Good to be back. Time is flying. Can't believe it's been 100 days, but a lot's happened. A lot of good's made. A lot of progress being made.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. 100 days in, what is it like being a senator? How is it different from what you thought?
Well, besides the proverbial drinking from a fire hose, look, as tough as some of the challenges are, I'll tell you, just one of the biggest highlights was the passage of the American Rescue Plan, right? One of the most historic acts of Congress since the New Deal. Just as important as it was to respond to COVID, it's a reminder of the power of government to do good when the political will is there and when the thoughtfulness goes into the work product.
Well, and let's talk about that, because this week there was the big address to Congress. You were there. There was a selfie of you watching with Dr. Jill Biden in the audience. He's pitching a whole lot of spending. You mentioned the American Rescue Plan. You already passed that. That was over $1.9 trillion in spending. Now the president wants to pass an infrastructure plan. That's called the American Jobs Plan. That's $2.3 trillion. Then there's also the American Families Plan. That's $1.8 trillion. That's largely focused on social services. So the question, Senator, is, so what do you say to critics who say $6 trillion in spending, way too much money? Government itself isn't all that good at spending money efficiently and wisely.
So, look, I want to talk about what is in the package and what we should be investing in, and also how to pay for it. I'm not shy about that conversation, but let's put it in a historical context here. When we were coming out of the Great Depression, did we let the concern about how we're going to pay for it keep us from investing in our nation's infrastructure back in the 30s, part of the New Deal? No, it's viewed through history as a big reason we rebounded as a country. Look at California specifically under Governor Pat Brown. You know, did we let the concern about how we're going to pay for it keep us from investing in, you know, our transportation infrastructure, from our university system, and so much more? No, it's those investments strategic that led to our success and prosperity. And that's the thinking that we're doing here. We're coming out of not just a COVID-19 health pandemic, but an economic pandemic as well. And through smart investments, not just in roads and bridges, in broadband, in healthcare, in housing, and from the American Families Plan, in, yes, childcare, educational opportunity, all those sorts of things, we can set the stage for America's working families to thrive and lock in our competitiveness for decades.
So and the way to pay for it would be to raise taxes on those making over $400,000, also raise taxes on some businesses as well. So your basic point would be, it's worth it.
Look, I think it's going to be a combination. The most wealthy families in America and large corporations should be paying their fair share. Some are paying too little. Some aren't paying anything at all. So that can underwrite a big part of the investment that we know is needed and we'll get a big, big return on. You know, could there be a little bit more deficit spending? That might be part of it. At the end of the day, interest rates are still low. So, you know, in investments in good terms for the federal government, it's still a pretty good time. But one area that's not being talked about nearly enough, which I think we should, is leveraging our dollars. I've been in public service for more than 20 years now. Most large-scale infrastructure projects have federal funding and state funding or local funding or maybe all three. We can stretch those dollars through leverage, and there's clearly opportunities for leveraging private investment with some public investment as well. So different ways to meet the cost, But let's not be shy. We know that significant strategic investments will reap benefits for years to come.
Now, this is possible that you could pass this along what's called reconciliation, which means you can do it with only Democratic support. You can't do that for a lot of the other big Democratic wish list items. I know you're a big proponent of getting rid of the filibuster. You talk about that all the time. But you got to convince some of your Democratic colleagues to do that. Where are you at on that? What does the future of the filibuster look like? And are you talking to some of your colleagues that are skeptical about that?
Yeah, look, on the filibuster, I think the trend continues. More and more of my colleagues, the hardest to convince or change their mind are coming around because they see the reluctance of our Republican colleagues to play ball, right? We were talking about the American Rescue Plan a few minutes ago. To think that urgent resources for families, for small businesses, for state and local governments across the country had to be done on a partisan basis because Republicans couldn't even bring themselves to do that. Now the ball's back in their court. Will they play ball with us on the investments in housing, in healthcare, in roads and bridges, in broadband deployment, or so much more? Or is it just all talk that they want to work on a bipartisan basis? Because the need is urgent. If they're ready to work, so are we. If they're not, then we have a way to act with the urgency that the situation calls for.
All right, real quickly before you go, we want to have a bit of fun as well. We play a game on this show called The Name Game. You've played this before, where we do one word to describe certain people. And now that you've been in the Senate, you've gotten to know some of these people a little better. One word that you think of when they come up. So here we go. Ready?
I'll get me in trouble now.
Okay. Senator Chuck Schumer.
Happy.
Senator Mitch McConnell.
Curmudgeon.
Senator Bernie Sanders.
Donuts.
Senator Lindsey Graham.
Which one?
Senator Cory Booker.
Pal.
Senator Ted Cruz.
Please.
And finally, the senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein.
Gracious.
So Bernie Sanders serve donuts? Is that a thing?
So of all the committees that I sit on, budget committees, the only one that has donuts and coffee in the back. So I thank Bernie Sanders.
I love to feed people as well. And last question, we've talked about your family before. How is your family adjusting to you being in D.C.? How do you make that work? How are you guys doing with this new life?
Well, I appreciate you asking. God bless my wife. Her love and support allows me to do what I do. We haven't quite found the rhythm or the groove yet, but that'll come. Boys are back in school in person, and so that's been a big change for the better as we're beginning to come out of this pandemic. We'll see. The job keeps me busy. It comes with some personal sacrifice, obviously, but we know that it's going to be worth it at the end of the day.
Our thanks to Senator Padilla. Now we get the view from the administration itself. Joe Biden's cabinet secretaries fanning out across the country virtually to sell his plan. We talked with the Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, and we began by talking about the state of the economy.
What would you say the state of the economy is?
Getting stronger every day.
Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo pointing to quarter one's booming GDP growth at 6.4%. One of the highest numbers in decades.
I think it's largely on account of the successful vaccination strategy.
I asked about concerns the economy may be overstimulated, raising inflation worries.
The economy is not overheated. By no measure is it overheated. Millions and millions and millions of Americans are working full-time in poverty. We have epic levels of homelessness. There is a role for government, not to give handouts. Americans don't want handouts, but they do want a chance.
The White House says the president's more than $2 trillion American jobs plan will create millions of jobs by renewing our electric grid, rebuilding our roads and bridges, and modernizing buildings.
Right now, do you have the votes to pass this plan just with the Democrats?
We have work to do. I'm not going to say that every member of Congress, even every Democrat, is fully on board with all aspects of it. There's an appetite for some compromise. The president wants compromise, so I like our chances.
As for Raimondo, I asked about leaving the State House in Rhode Island for Washington, D.C.
You know, when you're the governor, you're the governor, the one. Now I'm part of a team, but it's a fantastic team. But the president has set quite a pace. I think we're all struggling to keep up with him a little bit.
For governing, though, I'd go with Gina Raimondo, governor of Rhode Island.
Loyal viewers of The Issue Is may remember Raimondo's name from anti-Trump Republican strategist Mike Murphy zealously promoting her to be Joe Biden's VP pick last summer.
I've got to say before Bob does, of course, the great choice should be Gina Raimondo, the greatest Democratic governor in America of Rhode Island.
On his Hacks on Tap podcast, Mike mentioned her name almost every week for months.
I'm good friends with Mike Murphy. And so this is like talking to Jesus.
He is quite the fan. I'm not sure what I did to deserve his affection, but I'll take it.
Our thanks to Secretary Raimondo and our thanks to Mike Murphy. A special shout out to the Hacks on Tap podcast, which is fantastic. Finally, this week, Michael Knowles, conservative commentator from The Daily Wire. It's been a minute since we've talked to him. He's been really, really busy lately. We talked to him about the recall. We talked to him about big government. We talked to him about his new book. Here's Michael Knowles, and we began with his recent resume. There's a lot going on there. Michael Knowles, welcome back to The Issue Is. You must be exhausted with all of that going on.
It has been a busy couple of months, and so I'm sorry I haven't been with you in that time, but it's great to be back with you now.
It is good to have you back. You know, Democrats say that people need help right now. There's a lot of people hurting. The country, they say, have unfairly benefited for the wealthy for too long, and that the wealthy should pay their fair share. What say you?
Joe Biden is nothing if not consistent. He's not necessarily consistent in his policies. I think when it comes to that, he licks his index finger, puts it in the wind, and figures out which way it's blowing. But he's very consistent in his rhetoric. And this gets to what I think was the central theme of the pseudo State of the Union the other night. My podcast co-host Ted Cruz made this point that Joe Biden is boring but radical. So he speaks in these very calm tones and he's been around forever. But the policies he's pushing are radical and they're all moving in the same direction. What was so ridiculous, I felt, about his argument the other night where he said it's about time that the rich pay their fair share and the corporations pay their fair share is that millionaires and corporations voted for Joe Biden. They donated to Joe Biden. This old canard that the Republicans are the party of the plutocrats and the corporations, it just isn't true. Look at Coca-Cola, look at Delta, look at every major corporation in the country right now. They're shilling for Democrat policies and they are opposing Republican policies. In Georgia, they're opposing the voter integrity law. So to me, it's just so dishonest. We have the liberal edifice, the institutions of higher education, lower education, the corporations, the administrative government, the elected officials, big technology, the list goes on. And then the Democrats have the temerity to lecture us about institutional oppression and injustice. If the institutions are oppressing people, that would be the fault of the left because the left controls all of the institutions.
Well, you also wrote a column this week with sort of a different view called Three Cheers for Big Government. Here is what you said. We'll put this up on the screen. A coherent conservative movement does not embrace small, but rather limited government. When small government cannot meet the demands of justice, we must grow the state, if only to preserve our freedom. What do you mean by that?
I think I'm a heretic, according to the language of the last 20 years or so among conservatives. But it wasn't always that case. Barry Goldwater, Bill Buckley, Ronald Reagan, they always talked about the need to assert our political influence against any sort of unlimited giant institution, whether that is in the public sector or in the private sector. When you look at a company like Facebook or Google, is that a private company? Sort of, but it seems that they have the influence of a government to make our policies. And so I think a lot of the reason that we have lost the culture over the past 30, 40 years as conservatives is because we've set up this false dichotomy between public and private or between big government and small government. What we really want to do is preserve limited government. We want to make sure that there are limits on the power of gigantic actors, whether that's the government or the bureaucracy, or whether that's some woke multinational corporation. And it's long past due for Republicans to stop shilling for corporations that hate us, that hate our priorities, and want to totally upend the American political order.
But aren't they also corporations that in large part donate a lot of money to Republicans as well? Donate a lot of money to Democrats, but also donate a lot of money to Republicans.
Yes, this has been a big problem, and I was actually pleased to see Ted Cruz this week put out an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying he's not going to take corporate PAC money. Corporate PAC money breaks overwhelmingly for Democrats, but they do give to Republicans too. And so it leads to these ridiculous moments where you'll see Senate testimony and all the heads of these woke corporations will come in and the Republicans will give them a tongue lashing and they'll say, you have to stop censoring us. You have to stop undermining our laws, say in Georgia. But then nothing happens because the politicians are often in the pockets of the corporations, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. And I think it's time for us to reassert some old traditional American standards and defend the American way of life. And if we have to do that through the political system, I think that's perfectly right and just.
Let's talk for a moment about the future of the Republican Party. We have not had you back on the show since President Trump has been out of office. Where do you see the Republican Party going from here? Is it more Trumpism?
We haven't seen very much of Donald Trump either because not even after he left office, but even while he was still in office, major corporations silenced him. And it's really amazing to think that Donald Trump, one of the biggest celebrities in the world for, what, 30, 40 years, then the leader of the free world, could be totally silenced. But he really has. And well, so I think if the Republican Party, I mean, he still sends out his press releases that you'll notice read a whole lot like tweets and people will sometimes amplify them. But if the Republican Party is to have a future, we need to have, I suppose what you would say, more of Trumpism. And by that, I mean breaking off the old stale platitudes that said, in large part, that it is illegitimate for Republicans to wield political power, that we should never wield political power because that would make us no different from the left. And you've seen Republicans defending abstractions, largely, the abstraction of free speech, the abstraction of academic freedom, whatever. But those abstractions don't really have a lot to do with practice. I think the cultural battle right now is being framed by the left and the right as a battle between, say, free speech and censorship, or, you know, expressing our views and cancel culture. Really what it's about, and I discuss this at length in my upcoming book, Speechless, is it's a battle between two competing sets of standards. Free speech means very little to people who have nothing to say. And I think that Republicans, following President Trump's lead, but hopefully taking it much further, must articulate a substantive moral and political vision. The left understands a whole lot more about free speech and the exercise of political power than the right does. And I think it's long past time for us to take some notes and figure out how to effectively and competently wield that political power.
But don't you think it's a little bit much to say that President Trump has been silenced? I mean, if he would come on Fox News Channel, they would put him on anytime. He could come on your show anytime. He could come on this show anytime. I mean, if he did events, people would cover it. It's not like he's totally been silenced. It's just that he's not doing all that much.
Alex, I am very flattered that you think that my show has the reach to 330 million Americans. And someday I hope that it does. But the fact is, Google controls the public square. The public square today is a digital public square. It's not like the old days with town criers where you'd go out into a physical space. They control 90% of the flow of information around the internet. Facebook controls a large share too. And Twitter, though it's smaller, has a disproportionate effect because there's so many journalists on it who will amplify what people have to say. If you delete somebody from that digital space of conversation, if you unperson somebody, then sure, President Trump could hold a rally. I bet he'd get 20,000 people. He could come on Fox News, talk to 3 million people. Come on my show. I hope he talks to a zillion people, but however many that is, say it's a million people or half a million people, that is not enough to shape the public discourse because the left controls, even today, the major means of mass communication.
Although nothing, of course, compares to coming on The Issue Is. You know,
that's certainly true.
The state is coming back. This state is roaring back.
Governor Newsom signing $6.2 billion in small business relief this week as he continues to fight the recall efforts against him. We're back with Michael Knowles of The Daily Wire. Your boss, Ben Shapiro, recently moved you and your entire company out of California to Nashville because of the business environment here. What do you make of the recall, especially watching it from afar?
I'm upset that I don't get to be there for all of the craziness which is about to ensue. It seems that Caitlyn Jenner is now waving the banner of the conservative movement in California. Didn't see that one coming. But I am very pleased that I fled Mussolini's sinking ship in California. I did not turn back. I would have turned into a pillar of salt. And actually, we fled to Nashville. And if you look right now, Nashville is the city in the country where the most people are coming into. What state is losing people at some of the highest rates? It's California. And it's not because California ain't a beautiful place. I love California. The natural beauty alone is enough to make someone move there. But bad government, bad policies do have an effect. And even people who are not to the right of Attila the Hun, like I am, even people who are more in the center or even liberal, are fleeing because it's not a pleasant place to be right now. You've got crime surging, you've got homelessness surging, and you've got confiscatory taxes that make it virtually impossible to run a business.
Just to be clear, the census shows that we actually have had growth in the state. The rate of growth has slowed down from where it was in the past. In some other areas, the rate of growth has sped up. So with the recall, do you have a favorite?
I haven't looked at all of the candidates. I know that Caitlin is getting most of the attention here. But there are other people. There's the former mayor of San Diego who's running. There are a few other people who don't have the total ability to raise money, say, at the same level or name recognition. The problem with the Jenner candidacy is, of course, that you've got Caitlin may have very conservative views on a lot of issues, but on this really fundamental issue of the human nature, whether a man can be a woman and a woman can be a man, I suspect that's not going to play very well among a lot of conservatives. So I don't know. Recalls are always completely insane. And as you mentioned earlier, people are still coming into California. The country is still growing, right? You still have a ton of immigration in particular, legal and illegal immigration into Texas and California. But that's going to be a big issue as well. And, low taxes are all well and good, but that's not going to get people out of bed in the morning. No one wakes up in a cold sweat because of the marginal tax rate or the corporate tax rate or something like that. So I think a conservative, to really make a difference here, needs to be able to talk about cultural issues and needs to be able to assert a substantive view and transform the culture. Are the candidates who are up for the recall doing that? I'm not so sure. And so Governor Patrick Bateman over there, Mr. Newsom, I think may actually do fairly well.
You recently became a new dad, and I'm wondering, how has fatherhood changed you?
It is by an act of either providence or cosmic sadism. My book and my baby were due on the same day, and they were both delivered on the same day. I was typing away in the hospital room, and it was this amazing moment where I was so focused on this for months and months and months, and then I look and I see my baby and I realize, oh, it doesn't matter. All that matters is this kid. I mean, it really, really does put life into perspective. And I see you've got that photo there of my cute little son being baptized. A bizarre political factoid is he was baptized in Senator Lamar Alexander's punch bowl. How did the church get it? I have absolutely no idea. But that Senator Alexander has done a lot of good things in his career, including bringing my son into the body of Christ.
There you go. Welcome to Tennessee. Full service, apparently, in that state. All right, Michael, we always like to end with music. When you were here pre-pandemic, you once danced with Gloria Allred. Let's take a look.
Thank you, Gloria.
We bring people together here on The Issue Is. The left and right unite the love of Freddie Mercury. So I have to wonder, after that, did your conservatives friends say, who are you?
I think that many heads exploded from my left-wing friends and my right-wing friends. There have been many challenges because of COVID and because of the lockdowns, but I think my deepest regret is that I don't get to be in your studio right now, physically dancing with Gloria Allred. Hopefully someday again soon.
Thank you to Michael and to Secretary Raimondo and Senator Padilla. Thank you for listening to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. Hope you'll connect with me in social media at Alex Michelson. That's Alex with an E. Share out information about our podcast. That's how people get to hear us. And come back next week. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.